Understanding the nuance of American and Alaskan political history is a big undertaking, but political science professor and author Clive Thomas has done that and so much more, study and research into all things politics. He's taken his decades of observations and teaching in Alaska and used that knowledge to help write and edit a massive book that dives deep into the facets of Alaska's political structure and the laws that have developed from it. The author and the book, Alaska Politics and Public Policy, The Dynamics of Beliefs, Institutions, Personalities, and Power, is our conversation today on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
GCI, serving more than 100 Alaska communities. GCI's Alaska Born and Raised campaign celebrates the people who call Alaska home. GCI.com/share your story.
As an Alaskan, you love your salmon, but do you know the things you can do every day to make sure they're here for your children's children? Well, find out what you can do to ensure healthy runs for future generations of Alaskans at salmonproject.org/20ways. This message is sponsored by the Salmon Project.
Support for Alaska Public Media's Energy News Desk comes from Bettesworth North, Architects and Planners, and the Atwood Foundation.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, welcome to Talk of Alaska. Election Day, if you count weekends, is only about 36 days away, which is perhaps enough time to read Clive's new book and better prepare yourself for casting your vote. It weighs 5 pounds. Yes, I did weigh it. So you will get the added bonus of a little physical workout as you're perusing the chapters. Professor Thomas is here with us today. Welcome, Clive.
Thank you, Laurie. I'm delighted to be here, and the University of Alaska Press also appreciates the opportunity for me to come here.
Yeah, thanks so much for being here. Clive has spent more than 30 years teaching political science at the University of Alaska Southeast in Juneau. He has taught in numerous other countries and is originally from England. I want you to give us a little background before we discuss the book, but because you're from England, I have to ask, Beatles or Rolling Stones?
Oh, the Beatles. I'm not a real Mick Jagger fan, although Mick Jagger, actually, I went to the London School of Economics in England, and he was there a couple of years before me, but dropped out, and I think he made a little bit more money than me over the years. But I'm a Beatles fan, really, and a John Lennon fan particularly.
All right. Well, I knew that we were going to be friends for the future, and certainly we will be now, although I do like the Rolling Stones, too. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number statewide is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. If you're calling in Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422, or you can email us talk@alaskapublic.org if you have a burning political question or have always wondered about some policy thing that you just don't understand with the state of Alaska. This is the resource here we have in the studio today. Mr. Clive Thomas can probably answer your questions, or maybe you want to try some political trivia and see if you can stump Professor Thomas. Call in and try that out. So Clive, give us a little background about how you came to Alaska and got involved in politics here.
Well, as you say, Laurie, I'm originally from England, did most of my education there. I was went to school for a while in summers in Washington, D.C., and I actually interned in Congress in both houses. I moved to the United States in 1976. I taught at Iowa State University for 3 years, got divorced and wanted to move somewhere else. I've been brought up near the ocean, so I liked Iowa, but I wanted to move somewhere else. So I applied for 4 or 5 jobs, Colorado State, New Mexico. Alaska was the only place that would offer me a job. So I came to Alaska for a job. I didn't come for the scenery. I didn't come for the fishing. I didn't come to hunt. I didn't come for the outdoors. I came for a job. So I probably shouldn't have been allowed to come to Alaska for all those things. So actually, about 80% of people who come to Alaska come for a job. I was at UAS for 30 years. It used to be called UAJ until 1987, when they merged the community college system with the university. When I got here, they told me that I had to teach Alaska politics. They were starting an Alaska Studies program at UAJ at that time. I knew nothing about Alaska. I didn't even know who the governor was. They gave me 2 years before I had to teach it. I went immediately to the legislature to talk to people, to find out about Alaska politics, because I taught state government before for several years. And people were extremely open. I was very surprised. They said, come on in. They talked to me. When I was teaching at Iowa State, it was very hard to talk to legislators. People had done that for many years before. They were fed up with talking to academics. And so I taught Alaska politics. The first 4 or 5 years, I was rather apprehensive because most of the people sitting in that classroom in front of me were actually working for state government or been involved in politics. But by the early 90s, I felt much more confident. I wrote quite a few things on Alaska politics that were published. In 1999, I did a book on Alaska public policy, which is the last book that's been written on Alaska politics before this book.
This is your 11th book, is that correct?
No, it's my 14th book, actually.
14th.
Yeah, actually. But I'm really an interest group person. I've done a lot of work on interest groups, including Alaska. I've done stuff on Latin America, Europe. I'm actually working now on a project in the Balkans, which I've been involved with for about a year. So anyway, and then I kept teaching Alaska politics. In 1988, probably the thing I enjoyed the most about teaching here, I established an internship program in the legislature. Mm-hmm. I ran it for 25 years. We had 225 people go through that program in that time, two of whom got elected to the legislature, many, many of whom, probably over 100, have gone back to work in the legislature and other things. And we have many people working in the legislature now, and I'll just mention one person, but Governor Walker's legislative director, Darwin Peterson, was an intern for us in the mid-90s. So there are many people around the state that went through that program. So I continue to do it. I started this book in 2009, so it took almost 7 years to complete it, because it's, as you know, it's a massive book and would actually be a very good doorstop for those not interested in politics.
You mentioned that you interned in Congress. When was that?
1972 and 1973.
Okay. A very different time there than today?
Actually, I was there in the Watergate hearings in 73, and I actually did get to sit in one of the chambers where they were doing the investigation just for a couple of hours. I managed to get in there. So it was very interesting, yes. Very interesting.
Fascinating time. Clive, this book has 30 chapters. It's more than 1,200 pages long. When I was discussing it with a colleague the other day, she said, he needs an editor. I said, he is the editor.
Yeah.
Before we delve into the various segments of the book, tell us about its development and how it came together. The contributors to it are sort of a who's who of Alaska. Fran
right,
Ulmer,
yeah.
Julie Kitka, Gunnar Knapp, Mike Dugan, Emil Noddy, many others. How did you pull all of that together and wrangle so many clearly busy Alaska heavyweights?
Well, this is what happened, Lori. Because I'd written quite a bit of stuff on Alaska politics before, including actually a couple of chapters on Sarah Palin, but we can maybe go into that later. The University of Alaska Press director, long since gone, approached me, and he wanted a certain type of book. You know, Alaska has a very small population relatively, 740,000 today, I think, but around 685 when he approached me. And he, because there's no market for a separate high school text, a separate college text, and a general book for, you know, the general public who are interested in politics, he wanted me to do a book that would include, that could be used in high school, you know, for AP, advanced placement students, college, undergrads, grads, and for people in government, say, for example, who just come to the state and need an overview of a policy area. Also, for example, say a legislator gets elected, never been to Juneau before. They take one of their campaign workers and give them a job, and they're on transportation or education, and the only thing the staffer knows about transportation is that you can drive a car. The chapter there would be very helpful. So that was a thing. The general public, really, who are interested in things. So he also wanted a very practical book, and I've got to know a lot of politicians, a lot of journalists over the years, and so the book has 67 contributors, of whom 32 either authored or co-authored chapters, including, like you say, Fran Ulmer, Mike Dugan, my very good friend Dave Donaldson,
mm-hmm.
And some other people who are really experts in these areas. Then we have around 30, 35 people who did inserts, Tony Knowles, Wendy Chamberlain is a well-known lobbyist in Juneau.
There's a write-up by former Governor Bill Sheffield.
Yeah, Bill Sheffield. Yeah, well, actually a very interesting contrast.
Governor Hickel.
Yeah, between Hickel and Sheffield. Yes. You can see the difference in their personalities very well in this insert.
Yeah, so I enjoyed reading that.
Yeah, so many, many people did this. Tim Bradner, who many people may know, did a very good insert in the oil and gas chapter on the pipeline and the possibilities of that being developed or not. So that's what happened. And I was the editor. I had to piece all these things together and give it some integration, not just make it a series of essays. And so I did that. And I think it, you know, I don't know. I'm not the one to judge whether it turned out very well, but I certainly put a lot of time into it.
Well, I'll tell you that it was daunting when I first got it in the mail. I thought, oh, man. I was kind of afraid to open it because it just gave me school flashbacks. And
right,
so
yeah.
I thought, oh, no, it's yeah, right. textbook time.
Right, sure.
But I will tell you that when I finally did decide, okay, I got to crack this book and start studying up, I was very pleasantly surprised by how easily digestible it is to read. It's in a very kind of a conversational tone. There's nice stories, insert stories in there. There's great maps and graphs and such really tremendously useful information. I was talking to some of our reporters in the newsroom yesterday and said, this is going to be really valuable for all of you going forward. When you're working on a fisheries story or a transportation story or name it, any story that has to do with public policy and state government, here's a great reference tool for you to go back and look at some of the history of how these things came to be and where we're at currently. So I applaud the very outstanding effort that went into putting this book together. If you're just joining us, we are talking today with Professor Clive Thomas. He is one of the authors and the editor of a book called Alaska Politics and Public Policy. I'm going to hold it up so the camera can see it. The Dynamics of Beliefs, Institutions, Personalities, and Power. I love that subtitle. So this is a big book. It took some effort to lift it up there for people who will be seeing it on camera. The book is very current, too. I was surprised at how current it really is. Was it difficult to stop?
It was, actually. The book went to press on the 28th of May of this year. And up until the 26th, I was updating it. So it includes most of the things that happened in the legislature this year. You know, I tried to make it as current as possible. I would have finished the book earlier, but two major things happened in Congress in December. One of them was a rewrite of what used to be known as, or still known as, the No Child Left Behind Act. Mm-hmm. There was a new act called ESSA, Every Student Succeeds Act. And I had to include that because otherwise it would have been out of date. And then there was a reauthorization of the Transportation Act, the Federal Transportation Act, which provides funds for the states. And that was called the FAST Act, which stands for, I forget what it stands for, but it's something to do with transportation. So I included that. But, you know, you can never keep up. It's like running up an escalator that's going down, you know, as a kid. You can never quite get to the top. And what happened was, unfortunately, there is in a transportation chapter a section called A Tale of Two Bridges. And it's about the Ketchikan Bridge. And, of course, most people will remember that from the Bridge to Nowhere and Sarah Palin's talk at the acceptance speech at the 208 Republican Convention. And also the Kinnikahn Bridge, which many people here in Anchorage will know about. The Ketchikan Bridge was canceled, I think, in October of last year, so 2015. And the Kinnikahn Bridge looked very unlikely to be built. So I ended the insert saying, you know, it's very unlikely that the Kinnikahn Bridge would be built. And 2 weeks later, Governor Walker canceled it. So mm-hmm. there's one example of how you just can't keep up with what's going on. And it's rolling, but the book is not meant to be a current book. You know, many people say to me, well, it'll be out of date very soon. Mm. But it's not built that way. I mean, obviously the examples, some examples are current, but many are from the past. But it's really built around 12 themes of Alaska politics, which appear in Chapter 2. And these are really long-time and continuing elements of Alaska politics. So even in 15 or 20 years' time, though the book will be out of date, and some of the people in the book will be dead, and I'll probably be dead by then too, you can go back and look at these themes, which I don't think will change very much, and you could apply them to the present time. So it's not meant to be a, you know, with all due respect to all the people here, it's not a journalist-type book where you're talking about things today. It's meant to be something that can be used and applied, for the future.
Well, it certainly sets the political tone of the first 50 years of yes. Alaska. Yeah. So in that respect, it will be relevant as long as Alaska is Alaska.
Yeah, I guess in 20 years' time, it will be sort of a history book because I think it was Governor Knowles, Tony Knowles, when I was interviewing him and told him about this book, I think he said, or it may have been Governor Shepherd, I can't remember now, because I'm getting old and I forget things. He said it was a kind of a who's who of Alaska politics for the last 25 or 30 years, and in many ways it is.
If you'd like to join our conversation, if you have a question about Alaska policy or politics or the book itself, you can call 1-800-478-8255. That's statewide, 1-800-478-8255 or 478-TALK. In Anchorage, the number is 550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Did you structure the book as one that you imagine people would read in a linear fashion, or is it meant more as a reference book for specific areas of political discourse? I've been kind of frantically jumping around in the chapters, but I've realized that I really do want to go back and start at the beginning and read this book. It'll be a great exercise through the winter for me.
Yeah, well, the answer to that, Laurie, is yes and no. The book is structured in a sequential way, but you could, as you say, you could jump around and read particular chapters. You don't need to read the whole book to get a feel for things. But just in overview, it's set up like this. There are six sections to the book, which sounds mm-hmm. daunting, but they actually are pretty self-contained. The first section looks at the background to Alaska politics, the political environment. And Chapter 2 looks at these characteristics of Alaska policies. In Chapter 3, which is co-authored by Fran Ulmer and me, is about the policy process. Section 2 looks at influences on Alaska politics, the Constitution, the economy, two chapters on the economy, state revenues, which of course is very relevant at the present time, and then the role of Native Alaskans, the role of the federal government, which of course is a very emotional topic with some people in the state. And then we have a chapter on the role of government, because of course government is a very dominant force in Alaska. The second section looks at institutions, political parties, interest groups, the role of the governor in relation to legislature, courts, the budget. The fourth section looks at natural resources. Land policy, environment, very good chapter on fisheries by Bob King, excellent chapter on oil and gas by Doug Reynolds, who teaches at UAF, and then the permanent fund chapter by Scott Goldsmith, very, very good chapter, somewhat detailed, which is good. And then the fifth section looks at services, education, social services, which includes corrections in that chapter, and then transportation. The last section looks at the future for Alaska, and the very last chapter looks at some of the issues that might continue or crop up as the years go on. So that's the way it's put together. But you could, as you said, and you have done, dip in. So if you're interested in interest groups, you could read Chapter 15. Mm-hmm. If you just were interested in the present challenges, you could say crisis, but I'll euphemistically say challenges the state faces. You could say look at the state revenue chapter, Chapter 8. You could look at the budget chapter, Chapter 19. You could look at the permanent fund chapter, and you get a feel for those things without really reading the rest of the book, though, to read the first section, I think, would give you some very good background. There's also a very extensive glossary at the back of the book, which defines many, many concepts in Alaska politics. You know, what is a native corporation? What is limited entry? You know, the whole ideal of the concept we have in Alaska, the outside, with a uppercase O, which means everywhere except for Alaska.
Yes.
So it's, you know, it's meant, as I said, to appeal to a high school student, social studies teachers, all the way through to the general public.
I wanted to, we've got some callers on the line here that we'll get to in a moment, but before we delve into other questions, we had some breaking news today. A discovery, Kalis Energy says it's made a major oil discovery on the North Slope at Smith Bay. The company estimates that the oil under its current state leases at 6 billion barrels, says the complex as a whole may contain as much as 10 billion barrels. They're saying that this development could boost the amount of oil going down the Trans-Alaska pipeline by 200,000 barrels per day, about 40% increase over current daily averages. Now, of course, this sounds like great news for the TAPS line, not only for the state coffers, but also there's been concerns about low flow issues with the TAPS line. But is it also something you've been through 30 years of boom and bust?
Right, yeah.
Politically, is this beyond the financial implications, which are positive, is it worrisome that it might be, dodge the bullet, we don't have to worry now, let's go back to business as usual and spend money?
Yeah, you took the words right out of my mouth right here. This, by the way, is the first I've heard of this. I didn't get to read. Is it in the ADN?
It's a breaking news alert, and our DC correspondent had this morning. We had a lot of morning news this morning.
Yeah, I have not heard about this, but I can give you some reaction to it. Obviously, a good thing is, as you know, the pipeline is, the oil, the flow of oil for the pipeline is decreasing, and it's around 500,000 a day now, I think. The peak was 2.1 million, I think, on January the 14th, 1988. So there's concern not only about the decreasing price, as everyone knows, but also the flow. So this would, and I assume, I don't know, but it can tap in, it can be tapped into TAPS, then it would help the state, obviously. But it would, to use an extremely original phrase that you probably never heard of, it may kick the can down the road. In that regard, you know, I was here in 86, came here in 80, as I said, when we had oil below $10 a barrel, and there was all sorts of scrambling. Then we had the Gulf War, and it went up in 1990. We had other problems in the latter part of the Knowles administration, where it went down again to under $10 a barrel.
Yes, $9 a barrel.
And then it came, and then it sort of gradually rose. Murkowski came into office in 2002 with problems, and then it started to go up in 2004, 2005, and as you know, hit almost $150 a barrel in 2008, and stayed around 100, 110 until June of 2014. And I think that, in a sense, this is a good and a bad find. It obviously takes a long time to come, a while to come on tap, but it is, I think, once again, putting off the decision to make things. But I think this is human nature. People put off things at the last moment. When did you write your papers in college? Probably the night before you had to do them. And I think this is a human nature thing. And so it is unfortunate because, you know, the basic thing that the state has to do, and it's never been able to do it, is to sever, and really sever, the relationship between the price of oil and the state budget. And you know, the two are very, very closely interrelated, you know. And in the revenue chapter in that book, it goes into that very much detail. Scott Goldsmith goes into it in great detail in the permanent fund chapter. And that's something that's got to be done. But of course, when times are good, people don't think about it, especially when you have large capital budgets. And so, you know, it's kind of a, I don't know, there is a, in a Charles Dickens novel, there's a man called Mr. McCulber, and he always talks about things will always turn up. And they do. And in Alaska, they always have. And so maybe people think that that's what's going to happen.
Well, it will certainly add a really interesting dynamic to the elections and to the next legislative session, this conversation about what this could mean and what its implications are for taxes and a whole myriad of things. So it's going to be a very interesting conversation going forward. We're going to go to the phones here for a moment. Dan is in Cordova. Hi, Dan.
Hi. You there?
We're here.
We're here, yes.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to recommend to your guest that he go see, or maybe he has seen, Dick Reichman's play, The Ticket.
I saw it on Sunday. So I'm one step ahead of you.
Yeah, wasn't that fun? Boy,
it was pretty good, I thought. I thought it was very well done. Actually, I was there when the guest afterwards was artist Jerzyluski, who just, I think, turned 89.
Oh, very good.
And she was actually quite helpful to us in this book, so I put her in the acknowledgments. Yeah, I thought it was very good. I was here in 1990. A lot of that material in that play I didn't know about. But it was sort of interesting. I think it was quite well done. It was also very entertaining, I think.
Okay, very good. For those of us just on the street who live here all these years, the access to and the stories that the politicians tell is the wonderful benefit of living here, you know?
All right. Well, thanks.
Very good.
Thank you for the call, Dan.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Okay, let's take one more call here. Keene is in Anchorage. Hi, Keene.
Yes, hello. Hi. I just happened to be taking a class at UAA, Engineering and Legalities of Engineering, and one of my first tasks is to present a case where Sheffield was in an impeachment inquiry, and the New York Times said it was Sheffield's impeachment inquiry has overtones of Watergate scandal, and I was just wondering if you could chime in on that and maybe give me a little history lesson.
Well, it's I wouldn't say it was a part of the Watergate. It was a sort of, obviously it was a supposed quote-unquote scandal at the time. It probably was very politically motivated, I would say. In fact, not to be too self-serving, but I actually wrote an article on the Sheffield impeachment for a journal called State Legislatures, 1986. I don't have the reference here, but I wrote the article after the impeachment was basically dismissed, and you can get hold of that article. I think it's a good overview. And I'd only met Bill Sheffield once before that, but after that article, which he thought was very balanced, he was very nice to me, and I've been able to talk to him ever since. So that I don't think it was really a Watergate thing. But it was in a real episode in Alaska politics, basically, yes.
Seems to be very colorful. Well, thank you for your input, and I will definitely check out that article.
Yeah. You're welcome. Yeah.
All right. Thanks for the call, Keene. We are going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Professor Clive Thomas and the book, Alaska Politics and Public Policy, The Dynamics of Beliefs, Institutions, Personalities, and Power. As Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Alaska has one of the highest suicide rates in the nation, but together we can change that one life at a time. The Statewide Suicide Prevention Council has the resources and training to prevent suicide and support healing for individuals in need. Be the one to ask if someone is thinking about suicide and connect them to help. Visit StopSuicideAlaska.org to learn more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Our conversation today is about all things Alaska politics and public policy, the history of the formation of our political system, and the author and editor of a new book, Alaska Politics and Public Policy, The Dynamics of Beliefs, Institutions, Personalities, and Power, Professor Clive Thomas is our guest in studio today. And you can join our conversation if you have a political question or policy question, or you want to try to stump Professor Thomas with some political trivia, perhaps. 1-800-478-8255. 1-800-478-TALK is our number statewide. In Anchorage, 550-8422. 550-8422. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. Let's go back to the phones just for a moment. Susan is in Fairbanks. Hi, Susan.
Hi.
Do you have a question?
Yes, I do. I wanted to ask Clive Thomas if he could comment on the argument that's made by Don Young and Lisa Murkowski that the federal government is overreaching states' rights, and this is in regards to the issue of control of wildlife management in Alaska refuges. There was a rider on the Interior Appropriations Bill in Congress to let the U.S. Fish and Wildlife manage sport hunting in their refuges, and Lisa Murkowski and Don Young objected to it, calling it federal overreach.
Laurie, you have another 2 hours we could spend talking about this subject.
Special edition of Talk of Alaska today.
We need to go on to. Thanks very much for your question, Susan. I think it's a very good question. It really raises the whole question of the role of the federal government in Alaska, which, of course, is a massive subject and, of course, a very emotional one with many people. Once again, not to be self-serving, but Chapter 10 in this book looks in detail at the role of the federal government, and actually in a very balanced way, from an Alaska perspective, from a Washington D perspective. But getting back to the core of your question, the ideal of federal overreach, of course, is largely in the eye of the beholder. People often go back and they say, we've got to get back to the way the Constitution was written and what the Founding Fathers meant. Well, of course, there is no actual agreement on what the Founding Fathers meant. You know, one of the most famous conflicts in American history, as you probably know, is the fight between Hamilton and Jefferson. Hamilton was a nationalist who wanted a more national perspective, and Jefferson was a states' rights person until Jefferson became president, and then he became very Hamiltonian. So I think that there's a lot of discussion about this, and I don't know the answer of what is right or wrong. In the end, what determines the federal relationship is power. The federal government has a lot of influence, of course. It basics influence is through money, and Alaska gets a tremendous amount of that, more than any other state per capita. And so the whole question of federal overreach is a is in the eye of the beholder. I'm not saying it doesn't happen to those who believe it. Other people probably don't. The actual incident, question you're asking, I'm only semi-familiar with it, to be honest about it. I always learned in college, to be honest, if I didn't know much about it. I followed it slightly, but I think it's just a matter of interpretation about what should and should not be done. And of course, if we look at federal overreach from the perspective of those who want to develop the state, which you can understand, from the other reverse side, those who are environmentalists are very happy that the federal government's involved because they prevent things from happening that they wouldn't want. And once again, I'm not arguing for either side. I'm just saying that there are different perspectives on this, and this will always be the case in Alaska. And in the end, I think it will be settled by the power relationship. So I'm not sure you answered your question about the specifics, but I think that that general perspective, I think, is one that is important to consider.
We'll probably be settled by the courts at some point,
probably,
too, a lot
yeah,
of these decisions.
Probably, yes, yeah.
1-800, thanks for the call, Susan. 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide. 1-800-478-TALK in Anchorage, 550-8422. 550-8422. We're coming up on elections. Everyone's well aware of that. Chapter 14 of the book looks at campaigns and elections. You've studied politics not only clearly in Alaska, but other states and other countries. What kind of stands out about our political system or our elections and campaign system? Alaska has some very unique things that happen during elections. We have voters in very, very remote communities. Sometimes those votes, they get counted late at night, and people have to carry them in a boat from one location to the next. And so we have this really unique system in the state. How does it compare and contrast to other places?
Well, I'll answer that question, but if I can say one thing, Laurie.
Please do.
This book was published by the University of Alaska Press, which I think is important for people to know, and I really appreciate their work on this and so on, so I just like to mention that. In terms of elections, of course, there's many things to talk about. I'll just come up with a few. First of all, the American political system is quite different from most systems. Most systems are parliamentary systems that are basically dominated by the executive branch, who is usually drawn from parliament or whatever it might be, a legislature. The separation of powers system in the United States sort of pits the executive against the legislature. And we saw this very clearly in the last session. Getting to the specifics of elections in Alaska, I think there are a couple of things that I would bring out. One of them is that Alaska is a small state, population-wise, obviously not a small state geographically. And on that, in that sense, it's like Montana or Wyoming. And so the role of parties doesn't seem to be so important. And there's a lot of what we call friends and neighbors politics. You know, people can talk to their legislator. Mm-hmm. Even in Anchorage, a legislator here, certainly in the House, can walk around their district and not knock on every door, but knock on a lot of doors. So I think that a lot of it revolves around personality. In larger states like California, Massachusetts, Florida, it doesn't revolve around that so much because, you know, you can't get your legislator. An actual Senate, a state senator in California represents almost 600,000 people, which is only around 140,000 less than this entire state. So, you know, there's an amazing difference there. So I would say that. I would say that the cost of elections in Alaska is much lower than other states. Running for the House, running for governor, for example, I think there's never been a gubernatorial race that's cost more than $6 million in this state. I think the last one between Governor Parnell and the challenger, Bill Walker, now, of course, the governor, I think cost about $4.5 million. To go to the very other extreme, many people may remember the 2010 election in California, which cost $160 million. And so,
incredible.
Yeah. And in that fact, actually, although it's the past, by far the most expensive election ever in this state was the race between Sullivan and Begich last year for the Senate. That was $60 million. And I think it was $20 million for the fight against MAPA. So money is not big in the state. Friends and neighbors politics. And like you say, you know, very interesting issues with getting votes together. And of course, the whole language issue, which was solved maybe about a year ago for people to be able to have ballots or have someone to interpret for them in particularly Bush areas and so on. So in that regard, I think there's a lot of differences. In terms of campaigning, the cost, of course, certainly for statewide office is very, very expensive. Bill Shepherd in 1982, mainly because he funded his own campaign largely, was able to visit a lot of areas. Fran Ulmer in 2002 against Frank Murkowski couldn't do so much because, of course, she was not self-funded. So those are some points, I think, about elections.
The accessibility of Alaska politicians is something that, in the years that I've been here as a reporter and somebody working in news, I've been really impressed by everyone from state lawmakers to the governor to our congressional delegation. It's fairly easy to get to these folks and to talk to them. When I was a reporter in Wisconsin many years ago, that was not the case. You did not have such an easy time getting in to visit with the governor or get interviews directly with the governor. It was usually staffers that you were shunted off to talk to. So that's something that I think Alaskans really appreciate, is the fact that we do have accessibility to our political leaders. And we're going to go back.
Can I say a little bit about that quickly?
Please do.
I think that's true. And for me, as a academic, that was wonderful because I've interviewed many, many Alaskan legislators. I interviewed every governor except for Sarah Palin. So, though not Bill Walker, I haven't gotten to Bill Walker yet. But there's it's a double-edged sword, Laurie, because if you and I can get to the legislator or governor, so can everybody else. Mm. So they could cancel out what we do. I mean, but I think it's people like to feel that because this is kind of a populist state where people feel they should have access to their legislators. And I think that probably makes them feel good. But there is another side to that coin.
Well, and I want to talk about that a little bit. But first, we had an email question here from Joe, who says, a great interview that gives historical context that can inform recent public policy discussions of importance to the state, such as the PFD, oil taxes, etc., is the Clemtillion interview. And that's something that we aired on a program we have here called Addressing Alaskans. It's on our website. And he asks if you spoke with Clem in the development of the book.
No, I did not.
Okay.
No.
All right. Well, we've dealt with that question. And I wanted to ask about that idea of access and influence. We've been talking about the accessibility for the average Alaskan, but as you noted, that also means that others can have access to lawmakers too. What have been your observations about influence outside of the average voter on political leaders in Alaska, both in the state and outside influence on our political process here? I'm sure that it's changed greatly since the advent of TAPS, but give us a little context about that.
Well, I think, you know, you're right. A real watershed in the state was TAPS coming online in 1977. Before that time, of course, well, going right back, one of the reasons that there was a move for statehood was to get the fishing companies, the timber industry and the mining industry sort of to have some control over those because they were, you know, quite dominant and they were able to do this for the role of the federal government. And then, of course, after statehood, they were pretty dominant. After oil came online in 1977, I think the politics did change a little bit. And, of course, the oil companies, became a major force in the state. Looking at just sort of briefly the internal forces that shape the state, many do. The oil companies are one, education is another. The role of government in many ways, which, you know, like organizations like the Alaska Municipal League, which is an organization of local governments, some of the unions and so on, do. Interestingly enough, the organizations which I've done several surveys over the years, 30 years of the most influential organizations in the state, and they have not changed that much since the early 80s. The oil industry and the Association of Alaska School Boards have come up every time, right from 1980 through to 2010, which is the last time we did the update. But there are more and more organizations now that compete, some that weren't really very prominent then, like the Outdoor Council representing hunters and so on. From the outside, obviously, the force that has always been the most powerful and will always continue to be so is the federal government. But one thing we must realize is that federal government is not a monolith. So it's not the federal government, it's a monolith. It's various parts of the federal government. And I would say the group that has increased the most over the last, 30 or 40 years is the environmental community. You know, the Alaskan environmental movement on its own is quite weak. And that's not any reflection on some of my friends who are in the environmental movement here. But and if it were, then I think that there would be much more development in the state, which may be good or bad, depending on your perspective. And I'm making no judgment on that. I'm just trying to explain it. But the environmental community has become very influential in the state through large organizations, Wilderness Society and so on. So I think that's an outside influence. And, of course, the oil industry. Mm-hmm. But the oil industry is not running the state like a lot of people think. The oil industry has a very interesting situation in Alaska. Because most of the oil in the state is pumped off of state-owned land, 99% or so, there is no Royalty Owners Association in Alaska, like there is in Texas, in Oklahoma, and those people give major money to campaigners. So when they go and knock on a legislator's door, they don't say, as we would say in Britain, buzz off. They say, come on in. In Alaska, there's no organization like that. Plus, with the permanent fund and with the permanent fund dividend, there's an interesting sort of populist relationship. So although oil companies are fairly influential in the state, they don't run the state in terms of being able to dominate things. Sometimes they lose. They lost in the first attempt at MAPA back in 2012. So that's what I would say over the years, basically.
All right. Well, let's go back to the phones just for a moment. Caroline is in Anchorage. Hi.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I wanted to ask a question about Norway, but before that, a quick question about a personality you may have known. He was the instructor of Intro to the Petroleum Industry in Fairbanks. I think it was 72. I was a student. And after about 3 weeks, our professor was gone, and we found out that he was the new state or the first state pipeline coordinator. I wondered if you'd had a chance to visit with him. And then the quick question about Norway.
Okay.
Is they're sovereign over their resources as we are, and they're sitting on, after starting 14 years development after we did, they're sitting on $1 trillion in their legacy fund, as they call it, and we're here fighting over $54 billion. I know the way that that happened, but again, if you could comment on what we could do going forward in terms of getting the state's value from their resource when we find, and I hope we do, rare earth minerals.
Well, let me first of all say I don't know who the person was you were talking about in 1972. If you mention his name, I might know him, so I don't know that person. But as I say, if you mention it to me. Okay, back to the Norway and the Alaska thing, the Alaska Permanent Fund. There are actually two funds in Norway. One is a smaller fund, which is worth about $20 billion, and that whole has to be invested in the within Norway. The larger fund is called the Norway...
Sovereign Wealth.
Sovereign Fund, yeah, and global it's called. And it's worth actually, I think, moving towards the trillion mark, but I think it's about $900 billion mm-hmm. at the moment. As you say, it was just started in 1990. The Alaska Permanent Fund was started in 1976. To answer your question, I will go outside of the studio today and wear a disguise because I'm going to say something that might actually get some people very annoyed. But I'm going to say it because you asked the question. 25% of royalties and leases and so on go into the permanent fund. No taxes go into it. It's 25%. Sometimes that's raised a little bit. It can't go below 25% because of the Constitution. It's now at about $54 billion. If we'd never had a permanent fund dividend, which of course we do, the fund at the moment would be worth about $120 to $125 billion. So it would be 2.5 times larger. And those are not my figures. Those are the figures of Scott Goldsmith, used to be at the Institute of Social Economic Research, and he wrote the permanent fund chapter, an excellent chapter for those who might be interested in it. So I think that minerals, I don't know the actual revenue that would come from minerals, but I would guess, and this is me guessing based upon the knowledge I have, that it wouldn't come close to oil. The only way you'd get more money in the fund is if you raise the amount of money going into the fund and, of course, raise oil taxes, which, of course, that doesn't go into the fund, but it would be good for revenue. So I don't see anything in the future that would do that. Norway, of course, has massive amounts of oil, and so it taxes it very heavily. Plus, Norway has no permanent fund. And in fact, the way that the money is spent there, it's used for the budget, but it's largely determined by the government.
And they also tax heavily their citizens.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, they tax very heavily. But here's an irony about Norway. It's very much a green country. They give you a $5,000 subsidy if you buy an electric car, but most of their money that they collect is invested in oil and coal around the world. Not most, but a lot of it. So kind of ironical that they're investing in sort of greenhouse gas producing places, but in their own country, they're green.
It's
a little bit of irony of politics, I think.
All right. Well, thank you, Caroline. I hope that helped answer your question. There was a question here, and I'm going to ask it, and certainly you don't have to weigh in on this if you don't care to, but it's a question from a listener about what your thoughts are on the lawsuit that is currently taking place over the permanent fund dividend. And what does the book say about what the history of the fund was created for?
Well, you know, Laurie, there really isn't a definitive answer on this question. Once again, going back to Scott Goldsmith's chapter, and also many people, including many people I know, and you know, that I've interviewed over the years, there was a big discussion about the permanent fund as to whether it should be used for infrastructure, for developing the state, you know, roads and so on, or whether it should be a savings fund. I think at the time the state Senate was keen on having it as a development fund and the House a savings fund. It became a savings fund. And of course, it's been one of the most successful funds. It has the Permanent Fund Corporation has been very, very successful and gone beyond. It's supposed to get, or its goal is a 5% return. It gets about a 6.2 or 6.3 over the years, I think, as far as I remember. So there's that. And of course, then along comes the permanent fund dividend in 1982, actually in 80, but it was part of it was struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court. And so the dividend came in. And, you know, in the early years, it was a privilege. The first couple of years, it was a privilege, say maybe till the 85. But as years went on and people expected it, as my grandmother would say many times, Clive, today's privileges are tomorrow's demands. Mm-hmm. What turned out to be a privilege became a demand, and you hear all sorts of arguments about that. So I think that, you know, and once again, I hope I don't run into the politicians involved in this lawsuit, but I think that probably, you know, it is not in the best interest of the state of Alaska, in my opinion, to tie up revenue that goes into the permanent fund or potentially go, because it really hamstrings the state for the opportunities they might need in the future to have funds that they can have to deal with the state's financial problems. It's a good populist approach, and it may get people reelected or elected. And several of my good friends, actually legislators, support this, and we have discussions about it. But I personally don't think the lawsuit's a good idea. I don't think tying up the permanent fund is a good idea.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Clive Thomas about Alaska politics and the new book that he helped write and edit as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbaalaska.com.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. There was a question, Clive, from Chuck, who emailed us and said he did several online searches, can't find Alaska politics and public policy for sale. He says it's great to publicize a book, but it'd be nice to know where it's available. I will tell you, Chuck, Clive will give you a website, but you can also go to our website, alaskapublic.org, and look for Talk of Alaska. We have a link there to where you can buy the book. But Clive, also, where can he find it?
It's available on Amazon. It's available on Barnes & Noble. You can get it at Barnes & Noble here in town. And of course, you don't have to buy it. You could go to the library and get it out. But there is a website for the book, and the URL is this. It's alaskapas.com. So Alaska, P-A-S, all one word, alaskapas.com. So alaskapas.com. And if you go to that website, there are four areas that you can look at. You can look at about the book. You can look at the chapter list. You can look about a little bit about me and the two assistant editors. And at the very last one, it says purchase. It will tell you all about the book. And you can purchase individual chapters and so on. And at the end, there's a link to Amazon and to Barnes & Noble, but it's very easy to find on the web, as far as I know.
And also our website, too, alaskapublic.org. Yeah, sure. There's a link right there. Let's take one more quick call. We've only have a couple minutes left. Jean is in Fairbanks. Hi, Jean. Do you have a quick question?
Enjoying this very much. We moved here in the mid-60s, and I was amazed at the time to go into co-op in Fairbanks downtown and see Governor Bill Egan walking around having a cup of coffee and people coming up to him and saying things like, well, Bill, how's your sister? Stuff like that. And it was just such a revelation to someone coming from a large city. But our son, who was raised here now and is now in his mid-50s, always says that he thinks the demographics of the state changed really enormously after the pipeline. And I wonder if the book has examined that.
Yeah, I think... Sorry.
I mean, this was a very, very blue state, although I don't remember whether, you know, the colors were linked into the parties then, but it was a very Democratic state. Now it's very, very Republican, and I think that's happened since the pipeline.
Yes. Thanks, Gene. Thanks for the question.
Actually, interesting point. The blue and red, which always confused me, only came in 2000. I always saw left-wingers as reds and right-wingers as blues, but anyway, that changed. Directly, I don't know that that's approached in terms of the demographics. We certainly talk about the way that the pipeline changed things and that, you know, sadly, it increased crime, it increased many things. So that has changed the state a little bit. But the individual things, the meeting governors, are certainly the case. Just a couple of quick stories. People always said about Bill Egan, that if he backed into a cigarette machine, he'd turn around and try to shake its hand. when I first came to the state, I went to a party of singers, and I didn't like singing. I went into a room. There was a man rocking in the chair there and asked me what I was doing. I said, I work for the university. I asked him what he did, and he said, I work for the state. And I said, which department? He said, I don't work for a department. And I said, you must. He said, no, I'm the governor. It was Jay Hammond, and I didn't know who he was. Another experience I had was being in the elevator in the state office building. Bill Sheffield got in, who I knew fairly well by then because of my article about the impeachment. He was in there, and a lady got on, and she said, I know you. I know you. And he said, yeah. He said, I work for the state. He said, that's right. I know that. You know, so I have a couple of Tony Knoll stories, but I think we've run out of time.
Well, I have really enjoyed having you on, Clive. It's been great to learn a little bit. We didn't get to, as always, we didn't get to nearly half of the questions that I would have liked to have asked. But thanks so much to Professor Clive Thomas for being in the studio today. And for being the editor and one of the authors of this book that is a great reference tool and just an enjoyable read. The name of it is Alaska Politics and Public Policy, The Dynamics of Beliefs, Institutions, Personalities, and Power. And you can find a link to it on our website, alaskapublic.org, and also on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. Thanks to our tech engineer, Dave Waldron, and Wesley Early on phones. I'm Lori Townsend. We'll be back next week with the start of our political candidate discussions.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future that delivers oil today and sustains operations for tomorrow. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 directory for older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.